Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Internet Marketing. Welcome back to the show, where we give you the lowdown, the inside information, and the word from the experts to help you use the internet as part of your marketing machine. Internet Marketing is brought to you by AI Digital at www.ai-digital.com. In episode 39, Writing for the Web Revisited, we take another look at this subject, including how people read on the web, the proper use of links, things that every page should have, four questions you should always ask yourself about every web page you create. We'll also be hearing about a new tool from Google for finding out those key phrases, the ones that you should be optimizing your pages for. And we'll be talking to a man who has his CRM system talking nicely to Google AdWords, all coming up in Internet Marketing. Hello everyone, this is Andy White here, and I'm sitting with our resident expert, Mr. Daniel Rouse. And I have to apologise for the long delay in the show from the last show. I think we're probably about a month late now, but we are going to catch up. And we do have a fairly good excuse. Dan got married.
Yeah, I got married and went on honeymoon for a couple of weeks, which has obviously not helped help things. And then getting back to work, it's been a little busy. So yeah, a bit of a big life event, but it's been very good, very, very good fun.
Now, Dan, you know, as one married man to another, can I just, Andy's top tips for happy marriage. We'll take this off the podcast, but Andy's top tips, two main tips for happy marriage. Tip number one, your wife is always right, okay? And tip number two, your wife is still always right.
That sounds absolutely perfect. That sounds like customer service as well.
And now, Dan, what's this about you falling off your bike?
Yeah, that also didn't help as well. I was brutally attacked by a suicidal jogger. And on Brighton Seafront, and
you are joking, I hope.
No, absolutely not. Well, they weren't actually suicidal, but they leapt out in front of my bike, and I went headfirst into a cast iron bench, knocked myself out. So yeah, spent a bit of time in A&E with a concussion. So unfortunately, that delayed the schedule a little bit as well. So it's been exciting times.
You see, what happened, folks, is about 4 weeks ago, I came to these offices to meet Dan, and I was told that Dan has had an accident on his bike and isn't in. So you can imagine how I felt, but I subsequently found out that it was okay.
Yeah, it was a push bike, and I was going quite slowly. And we'll survive to tell another tale, I think.
And does that explain this large sort of policeman's helmet-like growth on top of your head at the moment, Dan?
That's just my hair, Andy.
Oh, sorry. Your head doesn't go all the way up inside it, then?
No, it's the new style.
Okay, we got a bit of news. Something about... What's this news about Google Insights, then, Dan?
Okay, well, quite often when we're talking about search optimization, we talk about key phrase research. What are people actually searching on? So you can identify the key phrases that people are interested in and shape your search campaign accordingly. We've always recommended Word Tracker in the past, or Nichebot, which was another one we thought was really good. Well, just to throw the market into chaos, which Google obviously often do, they've released something called Google Insights, which is in a beta format at the moment. So if you want to find it, you go to google.com/insights/search, and you'll find a tool there that allows you to put in search words and compare volumes for different search words, see it over a period of time, see what countries people were searching in, also see the variations of that term, and also see what's popular and what's growing in popularity.
Hang on now, is this not basically a reincarnation of Google Trends?
It kind of is, but it's very keyword specific, but it's something they've taken from Google Labs in terms of Google Trend, but they've given it a lot more to do with the keyword variants and the countries that it comes from. But you can also search by category. So they group keywords together as well. A lot of it is based on Google Trends, absolutely. The key difference between this and something like WordTrack or NicheBot is that WordTrack or NicheBot will give you a number, a volume of searches. So there were 55 per day searches. This gives you a comparative percentage. So it won't give you absolutes. But the key thing we always recommend is that you're working out, okay, if there's five variations of a term, which one do I get into my website? Do I get bed and breakfast, B&B, B&B? It's always a classic example we use. You put all three into Google Insights and it will literally tell you which one's getting the most search and where it's getting the most search and what the variations are and what people are using on a day-to-day basis.
Now, do we know, Dan, I've heard that apparently things like NicheBot and some of the other non-Google type services like this don't have full access to all of Google's database. Does Google Insights have full access to its own database?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume so. The one of the key things is that the Google database was only really available to a lot of academic institutions, and it cost an absolute fortune. It was an awful lot of money. So what we're probably seeing here is that this data used in comparison with these other tools is probably the best way of going about it. None of them really stand up on their own because what works in Google may not be the same with the other search engines. It's generally going to be pretty much the same, but we can assume that they've got access to their own full set of data. And they are using that full set of data. When you do a search, it goes back all the way to 2004. So there's a good number of years in there in terms of what Google Insight can offer. So we've shown it to people that are doing keyword research, and we've been using it ourselves, and it is fantastically useful. And it's getting better all the time. It's been a bit flaky for the last few weeks in terms of they're obviously beta testing it, but I'd certainly recommend you go and have a little play with it and seeing what you can find out.
So for those who want to do their own SEO, it certainly should be added to pretty near the top of the list. The list of tools to use to work out the best keywords to use.
100%. Should definitely be using it. Just double checking yourself in terms of the keywords that you're using and making sure they are the right ones and what people are using on a day-to-day basis.
Brilliant. Now, I hear there's some Twitter news as well. Twitter's been twittering, apparently.
Well, it's not so much complete news. I mean, the thing for me, I've always been quite suspicious of Twitter. Not that I don't think it's a good idea. Just for those that don't know, Twitter is kind of like the fact you can send a text message, but you can broadcast it to everyone. So you're kind of blogging in a text message format, is what I always say. So that you can put out these very short little blogs saying what you're doing, what you're interested in. You can kind of have conversations. You can follow other people's Twitters. They can follow yours, and you can publish this information as quickly as possible. Now,
this is called microblogging, is it? 140 characters you can do.
Precisely. It's precisely what it is. And I just think, first of all, my impression was like, that could be a really good way of wasting an awful lot of time. Because, again, it's like blogs. Unless there's some value to it, are people going to bother reading it? And how much value you can get into 140 characters?
Now, although, having said that, Dan, I have heard stories of people who wanted answers to questions and they've tweeted it. And because they've got lots of followers, they've got some good answers.
I completely agree. And this is it. There are lots of ways of doing this in a practical way. There's some great examples when people are traveling. They're going out and they're saying, you know, these are the things that I'm doing. I'm here. What's the best cafe to use? And all these kind of things. Now, what you can do, you can search on particular terms and see who's mentioning them. So if you go to search.twitter.com, put a search term in, like Google Alerts, it will tell you who's doing what on that particular term. And you can be updated on that term as well. So if you're brand monitoring on the cheap, you do Google Alerts. That'll tell you what's going on in the search engines, discussion forums and blogs. But you can also monitor the kind of the twittering that's going on, okay?
Sort of Twitter Vine.
It is a Twitter Vine. It tweets, actually, they're called, aren't they? Of course. So you can monitor the tweets that are kind of being tweeted out there and see what's being said. But one of the key things that I thought was, how can this be practically be used? And there's a few different examples of this, but a couple of tools that I found have been really useful. First of all, integrating your tweets with your blog, okay? Now, a tweet is not worth having as a blog entry, in my opinion. It doesn't work in the same way. But there is a tool for WordPress called Twitter Tools that puts a little sidebar into your WordPress blog and just shows the last few tweets that you've sent out. So it says, you know, what am I doing now? And you can see what's going on in real time. But the nice feature of the tool as well is that it will take a day's worth of tweets and it will create a blog post out of them. And you can then drop them in automatically into a Twitter folder within your blog if you want to. So not only can people see in real time what you're actually doing and understand, you know, any number of things that you could be interested in doing, But you can also put this information together automatically into a folder. So if people want to go back historically and look at it, they can find it. But it also can be searched as part of your WordPress blog as well. So it kind of adds into your blog a new element. And I think that's actually quite a nice, useful way of doing it if what you're tweeting about in the first place is interesting in any way.
Now, this reminds me a little bit of these widgets. We've used the word widgets before, haven't we, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you can put in your blog or website that... Excuse me, I'm going to cough. That's better. I won't bother editing that out. Where was I? Oh, yes. These widgets that you can put in your website or blog that show your Facebook account, your LinkedIn account, blah, blah, blah. What do you think of all those?
Yeah, I think... I mean, this is a WordPress widget, and it plugs into WordPress to show that stuff. I think it's great. I mean, I think if widgets can work really well in the right place if there's something useful. There's loads of Facebook widgets that are, you know, really useful, Facebook applications, basically, that can tell you what eBay auctions you're bidding on and various things like that. But again, there's lots that are being created for the sake of it. All boils down to the same thing that we've always gone about in internet marketing, is it's about decent quality content and useful functionality. If it's useful to the reader, at the end of the day, it's going to get used. So I always say tweet with caution. If you're going to use Twitter, make sure you're doing something that's useful, but you can integrate it into your blogs really well. Now, there's one other thing that I've been using with it that I found quite fun, and it's appealed to the geeky side of me. There's a tool for the iPhone, an iPhone application. Okay, iPhone applications, there's lots of useful ones coming out. There's quite a few now that integrate with your WordPress blog, so you can blog directly from your iPhone. But there's one called Twitterific, which allows you to tweet from your iPhone, and you can send pictures while you're doing it directly as well. So it's quite a nice little tool that if you're tweeting as you're doing things, as you're traveling around and so on, you can then send that directly to Twitter. That will automatically post to your blog, and you can send pictures directly to your blog and that kind of thing as well. So we've been playing around with tweeting from the iPhone straight into the blog and so on and so forth. And it brings it alive a bit more because it's happening in a mobile kind of way. So a couple of tools there to look at, Twitter tools and Twitterific, should I say, on the iPhone.
So how do you think these can be used in the field of internet marketing, Dan?
I think a lot of the stuff where you're building a blog around a personality brand, it's quite good to be updating people on the fly in terms of what you're doing. There's various different ways that people are using them in terms of posting questions, question and answers kind of situations, building groups around groups of friends that are using Twitter and that kind of thing. One of the things that I found quite interesting is that some people that I follow online, like Seth Godin, who does his blog, and Timothy Ferris, whose book we're going to talk about later on, they're updating on the fly what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. You can kind of get a picture of what's going on. And they're combining what they're talking about in their blogs with the tweets they did at the time as well. So that you've got the perspective of looking back on what's happened, but the real-time commentary on it as well. And there's some interesting things being tried out in that kind of area. So I think there's few and far between places that I'd say Twittering is actually being hugely effective, but it's quite fun, and there's some good applications for it.
Okay, Dan, well, that's fantastic. Let's talk about now the main subject, which I believe is writing for the web. And I know we've been here before, haven't we, Dan?
We have. I recently ran a training course for the staff at the Chartered Institute of Marketing. Now, the Chartered Institute of Marketing publish all sorts of materials through their website. And they've taken the great idea of stepping back, looking at their website, and actually assessing how they're writing. What it made me realize is that we talk so much about getting traffic to the website, looking at the analytics, using pay-per-click, using all these things like Twitter and blogs and all this clever stuff. But we don't ever refer back to the copy enough. So I just wanted to take a little step back and give some kind of top tips on writing for the web, why we need to think about it from such a particular perspective, and some of the key things we need to think about.
Okay, brilliant. Let's get cracking.
Okay, so the first thing we need to think about... There's been lots of studies and lots of information that's shown that people are very impatient when they read online, okay? We've referenced Jacob Nielsen's studies a million times. Go and have a look at useit.com if you want to reference those again, and just do a search on writing for the web, and you'll see a whole host of papers that he's written on this topic, okay? A couple of things. People don't necessarily read in a linear fashion, okay? They're not reading left to right, top to bottom. They could drop in any page of the website, and they're scanning. Okay.
Tell us something, Dan, just a personal observation. I don't think I've ever properly read a paragraph on the web. I find it so difficult. I do tend to just scan down. I just look at the headings.
Yeah, I think the key thing is that the BBC News website is always a great example of this, and we reference it quite regularly, is that if you're going to read down the page, you have to be completely bought in to what you've already read. So Yeah, 89% of user journeys start in a search engine. Somebody searches for something. The first thing they do is look through those results. Okay, and they look through the results they get in Google, let's say. Now, yet let alone reading a whole paragraph, people only read the first two or three words in the Google results. They'll scan for the first couple of words. If those aren't right, and we've talked about this in the past in terms of those, that blue line, that title comes from your page title and that paragraph comes from your meta description in your website. They're scanning those, they're picking out, they're looking for the keywords they've searched on. They see those, they're fairly likely to click on it if it's in the top five results. They click on that and they go to the web page. When they get to the web page, they're looking for confirmation that they found the right page. And this is where the writing for web stuff really kicks in. If the page title, the headings on the page, the keywords that you've searched on don't stand out on that page, you get a much higher bounce rate. You get lots of people leaving straight away because they're so used to looking at rubbish on the web, not finding what they're looking for, they just bounce straight back. You've got a very limited amount of time, less than a second basically, for people to scan your page. So your keywords that you're optimizing for in search optimization need to be used on the page in the headings and bolded up in the copy if possible, and I'll come back to that, so that it stands out immediately what the topic of this page is. Okay. Now, how we'd write for, say, a newspaper or a magazine article, we'd write in an intriguing way. We draw people in gradually. We might do some play on words and things like that. Doesn't work on the web in the same way because people are jumping into the website maybe five pages deep to look for a particular story. And if they are looking at a page and they're seeing some play on words, it's not going to reflect what they're searching for. It's a very much it does what it says on the tin kind of approach. It's very clear, concise, plain English. BBC News Stories, read a news story, the heading, the headline of the news story sums up the whole story in one line. That's what you want to do with your heading on the page. Okay. Then you've got a summary in bold. Okay. Web pages that have lots of content where you have to scroll down the page should have a summary. Okay. And the summary kind of sums up everything on the page and tell you what conclusions.
How long should that be, Dan? A couple of paragraphs?
It's literally a paragraph. Shouldn't be any longer than a paragraph, because then you can read that, scan it, and here's a summary. Yep, I'm actually now willing to commit myself to reading down the page and scrolling down the page.
And should that be in a different font to the rest of it, do you think?
I think the same font's fine, but it does need to be bold because it stands out as differently, visually differently. If you start mixing fonts, it can actually be a bit of a headache on the page and the page can start to be a bit messy. Equally, I'd kind of advise against using italic as well completely, because italic on a monitor, because of the shift, it just looks quite pixelated, so it's not a great thing. Okay, so if you start a page off with a headline that explains what it's about, or a good heading, you've got a summary, and summaries are suitable for some pages and not others. Okay, but then you've got a summary, then you want other ways of people being able to identify what the page is all about. So as you go through the text, don't be scared of splitting it into heading, one or two paragraphs, heading, one or two paragraphs, so that people can scan down the page and they can just, by reading the headings, work out what the key areas of text are and what the whole article is about.
Just a quick side issue. You know, you mentioned making that first sort of summary paragraph bold. Mm. Should people be using the B tag or the EM tag? I heard someone ask recently.
Yeah, they should be using strong or EM in the HTML, just because B is basically being kind of taken out of the HTML standard. So use EM or strong to actually bold words up rather than the B, because Google won't give it as much weighting then as well, because it's obviously following the web standards to look at what's bold and what's important.
So is that being depreciated in XHTML?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other key things as well is that you've got to be careful when you're bolding words. You shouldn't bold any more than about one word in every three lines of text, because otherwise it becomes horrible kind of jumble of all these bold words and they don't really stand out anymore because so many are bolded. Also, it really needs to be clear that bold and your links are different things. If you're using bold to identify your links, you can't use bold within your text because people just try and click on them all the time. So you should be using underlined text for your links. So don't use underline anywhere else. If you underline text on the page, people will try and click on it at the end of the day. And we've seen this happen an awful lot as well. So have to be quite careful of that. Okay. So you've got the summary, you've got the headings as you go through. The copy itself should be, and there's been several studies to prove this, should be 50% shorter than copy used in print. Okay. Because you can trim it down and trim it down. Don't take something from print and just copy and paste it online. People don't read in the same way. They want to get to the crux of the information quickly. as I've said before, people don't surf the web. It's a nonsense idea, really. They browse with an objective in mind. Now, even if that's browsing through the news, you want to be informed of what the latest headlines are. There is quite a serious objective in line there. So you've got your kind of summaries, you've got your headlines, you make your text concise. Within each paragraph, a paragraph will have a crux. There'll be something that's really important about that paragraph. You want to highlight the words in bold that bring out what that paragraph is all about. Okay.
Now, is this safe, Dan? Because I remember even as little as 8 months a year ago, I was hearing people say, oh no, you shouldn't sort of be bolding your keywords. That's considered a bit sort of black hat these days. Is that changing?
Well, I just think at the end of the day, the reason you bold a word is because it's important as part of the overall copy. Now, I don't think from having a few words bolded that Google is going to actually say, no, this is too black hat. In combination with another 100 different things, that may actually be an issue. But at the end of the day, how do we use bold in everyday kind of writing? It's to really bring out what something's about and highlight it and make it clear. And I think that's fine. I think that's absolutely fine. In combination with lots of other black hat kind of techniques, it might be a bad thing, because there's lots of tools that would automatically scan through things and pick out keywords and all that sort of thing. But I would suggest that on its own, it's not actually going to cause any problems. The other thing you want to do within your copy is look at where your links are going and the particular links that help people carry out an action. So if you've got fill out an inquiry form, you want to have that. You know, that phrase actually standing out, buy, sell, enter a competition. Those kind of words should be actually brought out as links, because action words work really well as links because they give you a next step. Okay. And what that brings me on to is the fact that every single page in your website should have a call to action. Okay. This is so often missed, and it's really worth going back and looking at it. A call to action in your page may be, fill this form in. Go and read another page. Here's more information. Even on a page where you've bought something and you completed a transaction, there should be a call to action. Are you also interested in? Get a discount if you buy more today. Go and find more information in this other section of the website. But if a page doesn't have a call to action, it's a waste of time, essentially, because you're not trying to actually achieve anything. Even if you've informed somebody of something, you're not offering them to learn more about it. So every page should have a call to action. Okay. And essentially, when you look at a page, you need to tick off 4 questions. Okay. You need to tick off, what am I doing here? So that's where your heading helps you out and explains what's going on, and you can quite clearly see what's going on. How do I do it? How do I go about achieving what I want to achieve? Can I just scan through this article and read it to get information? Do I need to fill something in to achieve an actual outcome objective? What's in it for me? What are the key benefits? What are your unique selling points of what you're actually trying to get across? Okay. And finally, where can I go next? What are my next steps? And if you look at every page from that perspective and take a step back, tip off those boxes, you'll actually find yourself realizing that the way we're writing for the web quite often isn't right. More often than not, when we write these, we deliver courses in writing for the web, and we're looking at websites ourselves, you'll find that building the website is the easy bit. The copy is actually the most difficult bit. And really, the web design process should start with the content, and then work towards the design, everything that wraps around it at the end of the day, okay? So it's really important to work out what you're trying to convey, how does it help the user, and what do they do next? And you'll quite often look at pages in your website and say, this page has absolutely no purpose other than stroking the ego of the company. Because the study that was done recently found that less than 1% of people read the blurb, for example, on the About Us page of a website. They don't really care, you know, how long your company's existed and that you're a market leader and so on and so forth. And if those are important points, put them in a bullet pointed list. Don't make people read paragraphs of text. Bullet point things. Put things in lists. Separate them by headings. Make the content really, really clear. We always do this great exercise where we get people to read 4 headlines from newspapers and try and work out what they're about. Okay, and it's very difficult to do. In a newspaper, you expect a certain type of writing, and it intrigues you to read more. That's great, but if you're on the web and you're in a search engine, you land on a page that's intriguing, you're going to leave because you're not going to be intrigued. You're going to be infuriated by the fact you've landed on a page and it doesn't make any sense to you. So I think going back to basics, really looking at what you're trying to achieve with the page, but also what the user is trying to achieve with the page, and look at it from that perspective.
Do you think there is... I might be going at the wrong path here, but do you think there might be a tendency from people who are trying to write their own content
to try and be a bit too fancy, and they need to just get back to basics, fundamentals.
Yeah, I think with writing generally, very few of us are trained writers at the end of the day. So unless you've studied how to write in plain English, it's actually a very hard thing to do. It's not easy by any stretch of the imagination. When you're getting people to edit their own writing, it's very difficult. And the problem is that you can't, it's very hard to take a step back because you know what you're trying to say. So to try and condense that down is actually quite a difficult thing to do. Quite often, peer review works really well. You get somebody else to say, okay, trim this content down for me, pull out the main headings, what word should I make into bold? And that really helps people refine down what's going on. Quite often, showing somebody that doesn't know what the page is about and doesn't necessarily understand it very clearly is the best way of doing it, because that's probably what your target audience is like. So I think, yeah, people, we tend to try and be quite creative and fanciful in our style of writing, but really what people you're trying to do is convey information. And a blog entry that's well written will get readers. A blog entry that solves a problem in a concise fashion will get a heck of a lot more readers because it actually achieves something. So if you're writing for the sake of writing so somebody reads it and you've got an audience, that's fine. People like your style of writing. But more often than that, that's not what we're trying to do on the web. We're trying to sell something or solve problems.
Daniel, is there anything further you wish to say on this topic?
No.
Well, Dan, there's some great tips there on writing for the web. Now, I hear we've had a few more emails, have we not?
We have. We seem to be getting a good steady flow of emails now. And there's a couple that have come in here that I just wanted to answer the questions that should be quite practical for people on an SEO basis. The first one here is from James Long from a company called Born.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And the question is basically about copy length that could be good for search. And basically James has said, please could you help me clarify whether it is preferable for SEO to have long copy on a page, some advocate 200 words plus, or as Jacob Nelson argues, keep it very short and sweet. Now, this ties in very closely to what we've just been talking about of writing for the web as well. For the page functionality wise, you want to keep it as short and sweet as is possible. You don't want to make people read lots of words, but you need to give Google enough so it can understand what your page is all about. My advice generally on this topic is that the user comes first. So if you've got a page that's got your key phrases in the page title, in the heading, in the copy, in the alt tags, in the meta, in the background, you don't need to write hundreds of words. You know, in an ideal world for a search point of view, a couple of hundred words would be great. But realistically, if it's going to ruin the user experience, there's no point, because you can get hundreds of users to a website, but if it's no fun to use, then you've kind of defeated yourself already. So what I tend to try and do is make sure the pages that the users are coming across all the time are as short and sharp as possible, are clean, easy to follow and easy to understand. You may have other pages where you want to put in longer definitions, descriptions, longer pieces that when people are committed to a page and they're actually interested, they can read on more. But fundamentally, you can get over some shortcomings in on-page optimization. So your page may not be perfectly optimized in terms of the number of words and things like that if you've got plenty of links coming through to your website. So really good link building can overcome some of the imbalances that on-page optimization may cause. All that Google's looking for is indication of what the page is about, and then they're really looking to see how popular that is in terms of the inbound links. So users first, copy length. Ideally, you do want a bit of copy there for Google, but don't add copy just for the sake of the search engines, in my opinion.
It's a bit like what you were saying earlier, wasn't it, about have a sort of summary paragraph and then maybe with a link to read more, or a link that is formed around a sort of word that goes onto a relevant longer piece of text somewhere.
That's absolutely right. And if you do it that, it gives the user the opportunity to basically do what they want to do. Do they want to read more, or do they want to keep it short and concise? Make through the flow through the page really easy. Bring out the keywords. If you have got 200 words, make sure that there's a couple of headings in there. There's some clear links and there's some clear calls to action. So you can have the copy, but a page will still be usable. So you can balance the two things up, but it's not the easiest thing to do in the world. Just remember, Jacob Nielsen is coming at it from a pure usability point of view. He's not considering the search engines, and a little bit of balance between the two is good. Users first, search engine second, though.
Can I ask you, Dan, in your opinion, you know you have H1 and H2 and H3. What does it go up to? H4, 5, 6?
H6, I believe, off the top of my head.
People ever use H4, 5 and 6?
No, I don't think they do, really. And to be honest, how much weighting Google would give it, I don't really know. I mean, what we always advise is use an H1 for your main heading, and you may have a couple of H2s for subheadings, even down to H3s. I've never really built that many websites that go past an H3, just because we didn't really feel it was that necessary. But from an accessibility point of view, they're sometimes used to balance the weighting of the headings and things like that. So, you know, if you need six different levels of headings, then use them. But for example, if you've got top 10 tips, you might find that all top 10 of your tips are H2s because of the fact they're all of equal importance. You've got a main heading. So, I don't really go past an H3 or an H4. There may be some other people that have got experience of that. So I'd be interested if anybody's kind of tried anything different, then let us know.
Okay, Dan, there was another email, wasn't there? What was the other question? Or had you not finished with James?
No, I think that's all that James was really asking at that point. The other question we've got here is from John Shipman at Friendly Baby. And the web address is friendlybaby.co.uk. So there's a free plug. Basically flattering the podcast, which always gets you a listen and gets you a mention in the podcast. What they're actually saying is that...
Hang on, read out the comment.
Oh, the friendly comment.
The nice comment, yes.
This is, thanks for a very informative podcast. I've been listening to it regularly since launched online business last year, and it's been very useful in launching the business. So it always gets you a mention. A bit of flattery will get you everywhere in this podcast. The key, there's two kind of questions that come in as part of SEO, okay? So first of all, should we be optimizing our pages on a page-by-page basis or by a website overall? Okay, which is an interesting one, because each page should be optimized individually for the content of that page. Where this becomes difficult is when you've got your homepage and your subsection or your category pages that you're trying to optimize for multiple terms. Okay, so in this case, we sell mainly cloth nappies. So should every page on the site have a title starting with cloth nappies, or is that inappropriate for the pages selling organic soft toys? Well, I would suggest it probably is inappropriate for the pages selling organic soft toys. What you really want to do is for each page, there'll be a set of key phrases you want to optimize for, and you want to get those phrases into the page. Okay, if you have one key product, you may want to mention that in the page title, at the end of the page title, near the end of the page title, on every page as well. But really think of it on a page-by-page basis. When you come to the categories and the home page, the difficult thing is trimming it down. And you have to just trim it down to what the top most, probably two or three important phrases are per page. So I wouldn't suggest optimizing a page for more than two or three phrases. Okay. But then this is when it comes into the second part of the question. So what he's actually, John's asking then, is what if there's several different names for a product? Okay. Cloth nappies are also known as reusable nappies, washable nappies, cotton nappies, terry nappies, real nappies. Well, what you have to do is what we've talked about before. You go to something like Word Tracker or to Google Insights that we talked about earlier on, put in all the variations and see which ones people are searching on. And you pick out the ones that are getting the most volume of searches. And you try and use both variations of the different words on the page at the end of the day. If you used all of the variations of those phrases on one page, it'd probably read like rubbish. So the key thing is to try and optimize for the top phrases, then go through and reread the page. And if it reads like it's been optimized, you've probably gone too far. So you just need to get your top terms in there.
Dan, are the days of having a separate page dedicated to each of the separate pseudonyms for Terry Nappies, are they sort of gone and deemed to be very black hat these days?
It's a bit of a dubious practice, because what you're basically doing is creating pages for the search engines, kind of landing pages. And it's a bit of a frowned upon thing, because again, you're going to be repeating your content an awful lot, just with different variations of the phrase in it. There's nothing actually wrong with on the page having a little box saying Nappies also known as, and giving the four or five variations, because people may not click with that particular term. Different people will come at it from a different point of view. So think of it from the user point of view and what you can give the user that's also going to help the search engines at the end of the day. So I think that's a very good question, because it's quite a practical one that comes across quite regularly.
Brilliant. And we've had a comment, I believe.
We have. Again, flattery gets you everywhere. It's a comment here from Louise Payne. Louise is working on a couple of... She's communication managers for the largest government ministry. So it's brighterfutures.gov.ky in the Cayman Islands. So our listenership is getting around the world quite nicely now. And again, the Cayman Islands website is caymanislands.ky, if you want to have a look at that. What they're basically saying is that, the technology is really kind of changing how they're working. But they're particularly interested in growing the small Caribbean markets and looking at how small regions, geographic regions, can actually be tapped into by digital marketing. Now, this is a topic we could go into in quite a length, so I'm going to try and bring this up in a future podcast. But I think it's quite a valid thing in that you can go for big markets, big mass markets, but focusing on niche markets, there's also something that's really, really strong there, and we've talked about that in the past. And geographical targeting, particularly in pay-per-click advertising now, which is much easier to do, can give you really, really good results. So thank you for the really kind of positive comments that we've had feedback from, particularly from Louise. That's great. And I will go into that localized marketing thing a bit more in the future, I think.
And if I'm ever in the Cayman Islands, I'll pop in for a coffee.
Sounds like a very good idea. In fact, maybe we should be invited for a coffee, and then maybe we could go over that. That'd be good.
Is that a hint, Dan?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Well, Daniel Rouse, thank you very, very much for your insights on this fine day. So we're now going to finish off with an interview I did with Kieran Rogers, or at least part one of an interview I did with Kieran Rogers. Tell us a little bit about Kieran, Dan.
Kieran works for the marketing of somewhere called UKSA, which is the UK Sailing Association. And they're based in the Isle of Wight. And they're a charitable trust that does lots of fantastic things. Basically, they provide lots of opportunities for young people to go and try sailing for a day. They do qualifications for people who want to be yacht masters. But it's also up on a charitable basis, so that you give these opportunities to young people, expands their confidence, not necessarily to get them into sailing for a whole kind of a lifetime, but to kind of build the confidence. And I'm sure that Kieran will explain what they do an awful lot better than me. But what happened is I went along there for a day to do a kind of strategic consultancy with them, have a look through their digital marketing and give them some advice on what they could actually do better and how they could achieve these things and kind of achieve their objectives through digital marketing. What I found was that I probably learned as much on that day as I actually gave, but we're not going to tell Kieran that, because otherwise he might want some of his money back. But yeah, literally, they were doing some really clever stuff. And I thought that it's all stuff I've come across before, but some of it was being brought together in a really good way. There's some great stuff with integration into customer relationship management and so on. So I thought it'd be a great opportunity for Kieran to talk about what they've done, how they've approached it, and what results they've got from it.
Fantastic. Well, here's part one of that interview just coming up now. Enjoy. Well, I'm talking to Kieran Rogers of UKSA, which is a sailing charity. Is that right, Kieran?
Yeah, we are.
And you're based in the Isle of Wight?
We are based in Cowes in the Isle of Wight.
And for those of you that don't live in the UK, the Isle of Wight is separated from the UK mainland. It sort of hangs right off the very bottom. And it's separated by a stretch of water called the Solent, is that correct?
It is, yeah. Great place for a sailing school, because the Solent's a very challenging sailing place.
Is it? Why is that? Is that because there's lots of currents going through it?
Yeah, you have. I mean, you've got the sort of up to 6 knots of tide rushing through in various directions at different points in the day. So it kind of really adds to the challenge.
So it's not a good idea to try and swim across to the Isle of Wight, then?
I wouldn't recommend it. I know the ferry fares are quite high, but, it's just not a good saving.
No, no.
Best to get here alive.
Now, you're a sailing charity then, and I'm very interested in the way that you're using some online software, aren't you, called Salesforce for your CRM?
Yeah.
And I believe that you're using it in a very sort of close way with Google AdWords. Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, the thing we use is called Salesforce.com. It's an online customer relationship management system. And we're making use of it because as a charity, we get a donation of free licenses for it.
Mm.
And the real thing that got me using it was about 6 years ago. I was really we were just getting into online advertising, and we had Google. We were getting into Google AdWords and Yahoo. We're running some big online advertising services at the time, and we really wanted to find a way of not just being able to see who had clicked on our adverts, but the systems would always give you numbers and how many click-throughs that you'd had. I actually wanted to be able to track that business right the way through to booking and possibly subsequent bookings. And it's a really, really hard thing to do. One of the things I love about the online application we use, Salesforce.com, is there was a free bolt-on that we got hold of called Salesforce for Google AdWords.
Yeah.
And what that enables us to do is to track all of our AdWord responses through to actual inquiries. So if you were to go on to AdWords and respond to one of the many AdWords campaigns that we've got up there, if you were to actually ask for a prospectus off the back of following that AdWord at any stage, I would know which AdWord campaign you'd come from, which is really, really useful. Obviously, one of the big challenges with AdWords is knowing how much money to assign to various campaigns. As a charity, we've got quite limited budgets, so I want to make sure that we get the best return on our investment. And actually being able to track through to an actual booking within our system was extremely useful. I think it's probably a little bit easier if you just sell stuff online, because obviously you can integrate that into your Google AdWords campaigns. But for us, we have we do a lot of career retraining for people in the industry. So you can come to UKSA and you can retrain to become a yacht skipper or a water sports instructor. And these programs will range anything from £1,250 to £23,000, depending on what you book with us. And most people won't just kind of rock up into an online shop and make a purchase like that. It's like, yeah, £23,000, I'll have three of those, please. You know, it takes a little bit of contemplation and mulling over. And that's one of the great things about this system. It enables people to mull over, and I can still kind of track what success the various campaigns have had.
Now, before we get into the details of this, Kieran, I'm just quite interested because software as a service, of which Salesforce.com is an example, seems to be gradually gaining popularity, not as fast as I thought it might do. It does seem to be gradually gaining popularity. But one of the big things that I hear a lot of companies kind of worry about with online services is data protection and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What's your attitude to that? How did you sort of reconcile that in your mind?
When we first started using it, really uneasy about it. I had lots of awkward questions about it. Actually, it's just a mindset you need to kind of get over yourself with. I draw a parallel with the difference between keeping money in a bank or stuffing it under your mattress of your own making.
Mm.
And, you know, actually, when you look at the system we use, Salesforce, they say they're not in the kind of application business. They say they're in the trust business. And that's primarily why, because I think that's the big concern people have. The irony is when you look at the systems that we were using previous to using Salesforce, we had access databases which were backed up on tape and taken home by the guy from finance once every other day.
Yeah.
To cover every eventuality. Now, what I've moved on to is a platform which is obviously online, but they have backup centers in three major continents around the world, all mirrored. Right.
Yeah,
they have a 99.9% uptime kind of track record.
Yeah,
there's a site called trust.salesforce.com which you can go on and actually get their latest stats, which they've reopened and published. So I would say it's extremely secure and far more secure than your own kind of internal systems could ever be.
Yes.
And the other nice thing is that they're backing up my data far more often than I could hit the save button. So it's, there really isn't an issue. And if you take that whole analogy of, well, you know, are you better off building your own vault and keeping your money safe, or is it best to actually go with a professional service provider who spend and invest millions of pounds on your security? You wouldn't have any arguments. The banks would win every time.
That's a very good way of putting it, actually, because I never really thought of it in that way, sort of comparing it to a bank. Now, how does this actually work? I know it's difficult to describe to the listeners because we're audio, we're not video.
Yeah.
But essentially, in sort of a very generic way, because I'm interested also for listeners who are thinking of maybe trying to implement this, but maybe not using Salesforce, maybe they're using some other sort of online service. Roughly, how does it work?
Well, I wouldn't know about the other online services because, like I said, I've got this and it works really well. But essentially, you with Salesforce.com, they've developed it as a platform. So think of it not just as a service, but something you can actually develop software on. But the software is all online. They have a thing called the App Exchange, which you can bolt in kind of extra bits to your database, really, and they're all things that hundreds of other companies have developed and made available. Some of them you pay for, some of them are free. The Google AdWords for Salesforce is one of the free ones, and you basically install it into your Salesforce.com instance. It literally takes a couple of clicks of your button and it's all there, and they'll give you a little bit of code which you have to pop onto the bottom of all of your landing pages. So wherever, basically your landing pages are your pages which you link to your AdWords campaign. So if I clicked on an AdWords advert within Google, this would be the page that my advert would take you through to. So the little bit of code for Salesforce for Google AdWords goes onto the very bottom of that page.
And it goes into the landing page, does it, Kieran?
Goes into the landing page.
I'm with you,
And the whole system takes care of the rest, really. There's a feature within Salesforce called dashboards, which gives you a graphical representation of all of your data. And the Salesforce for Google AdWords comes with a ready prepared dashboard. So I have lots of lovely dials and graphs showing how various campaigns are doing, what my top five keywords are, how much money they've generated. And because it's integrating with my CRM package, it's not just how many closed sales each campaign has generated, but how many sales are sort of still in the pipeline. So we might have recognized something as an opportunity, but hasn't yet closed, i.e. you haven't yet bought the product. And I could see how much is about to come through. Very useful for cash flow forecasting as well, obviously.
And I'm assuming... Sorry, Kieran, carry on, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a really nice integration. I've always had difficulty with previous databases with, you know, one system talking with the other. And it was a big problem getting our website talking with the database until we started using this online platform. The thing comes with very easy to build web, they call them a web to lead form. So I can literally select any fields within my database that I want to make available on my website and create a web to lead form. So that when you fill out the various fields that I've selected, it goes straight into my customer relationship management database and gets dealt with there.
What sort of data are you collecting, Kieran, like that?
Well, primarily names, addresses, telephone numbers, and which course you're interested in. Primarily, we offer training for people. But again, that was a big problem that we faced. We used to have standard HTML forms, which would email our sales team. But as we got really into online advertising and AdWords campaigns, we saw the level of inquiry go up and up and up, and we were just swamped because what we were having to do is to print out emails and manually type them into the database system.
Yes.
So effectively what's nice about this is it enables my customers to fill out all their own requests. They're doing quite a lot of the legwork for us, and because we can customize the web to lead forms, we include all sorts of qualifying questions on our forms, like, you know, when are you looking to do a course next month, next 3 months, next 6 months? You know how you can fund the course? Do you know which course you're interested in? All of those things help qualify somebody who's really very keen to do something quite quickly to somebody who's just having a little bit of a daydream and perhaps, you know, just exploring a few ideas.
I love this idea of automation that you've got there. Obviously, presumably, when this information comes into the CRM system, the CRM system is then sort of doing things to help you waft these people further into the sales funnel.
Yeah, it does. And the whole thing integrates with the ability to email out campaigns to people that fulfill certain criteria. And much of this can be automated.
Yeah.
I'm well renowned within our organization for being very tight-fisted with money. But I work for charities, my justification. And that was one of the other things I liked about it, was the thing's very drag and drop. You know, you don't need lots of coding knowledge to automate processes and to customize things the way you like them. And, you know, before I started using this, we would very often pay £60 an hour to have somebody code in Access or various applications we're using. And I don't have that anymore, which is nice.
Yeah. I can think of a few organizations that I know that could do with a system similar to this.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I guess you'll have guessed. I'll hold my hand up. I'm a big Salesforce fan, but it's because it's a bloody useful tool. It's not through any weird obsession I have with the thing. It just helps us work more efficiently. And what it's given us as a charity, there's no way I could have afforded to develop something like this with the budgets that I work on. But through the donation of their licenses to a non-profit, they've given us a world-class Rolls-Royce level tool to use, and that's all part of their corporate social responsibility. You know, they're really interested in making the world a better place as well as making a profit, so
yeah,
ties in nicely.
But it sounds like a good system, you know, sort of binding in the sort of AdWord campaign to your CRM system. And it's certainly, I wonder if there's any other charities listening out there that might want to consider this.
Yeah, I mean, if they are, another hat that I wear, I run a non-profit group for charities who make use of Salesforce. Log on to Salesforce and look up the UK non-profit group and join in. It's a free group. We meet once every 6 weeks in London, and we talk about stuff like this. So, the aim is to help and encourage people to get the most out of the application.
Well, listen, Kieran, thank you so much for that. What we're going to do is we're actually going to make two little sessions out of this. So I'll say goodbye now, but we'll have part two in the next episode of Internet Marketing. So just before we go, Kieran, if people want to have a look at your website, what's the URL?
You can go to www.uksa.org.
Fantastic. Kieran Rogers of UKSA, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Now, we would really like to hear from you. So if you have any questions or comments, send them to info@ai-digital.com and feel free to send in MP3 files as well and we'll play them. If you're a subscriber, we'd like to thank you for your valuable time. If you haven't subscribed yet and you'd like this show delivered to your earbuds automatically, you can find Internet Marketing on iTunes. Just search under the Business and Marketing and Management categories. Or you can find us at Feedburner at feeds.feedburner.com/academyim. We'd also encourage you to leave comments on iTunes. Well, this is Andy White signing off, wishing you the best until we see you next time on Internet Marketing.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.